We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Christopher Bedford, senior editor at the Federalist, also a co-founder over at RightForge. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be back.
I feel like I forgot to put my Do Not Disturb on, so everybody just do not be disturbed by the lack of Do Not Disturb. I think there was a text message that just came in. Chris, there are some updates on Capitol Hill. It's a midterm election year. Democrats understand, especially after we're taping this on, what day is it, Wednesday? The shocking results. It is. The shocking results on Tuesday in the Rio Grande Valley, where Maya Flores won in did you see these results, Chris?
Yeah, she absolutely crushed the opposition.
Sean Trendy said some of the results from last night looked like Appalachia in 2010. What do you make of that, Chris?
It's symbolic of the complete and total change that we've seen in the Democratic Party, Republican Party via the Hispanic community, especially those who are on the border. It's no longer just Cubans who are conservative, and it's been changing for a long time. I mean, I remember Tucker and others predicting in 2016 that Donald Trump would get more Hispanic votes than George W. Bush and Mitt Romney had while they were criticizing him for talking about things like the border and talking about things and law and order and different things that really had a strong impact on these communities. And, you know, she ran. She's the first congresswoman now who was born in Mexico. She was running against a pro-life, law and order Democrat. At least that's how he tried to fashion himself. But no one was buying it because the party is so anti-life and so anti-border security, which I think had more to do with it, that she was able to dominate. But now the press, which is obsessed with everything, the first LGBTQ, curly-haired, cross-eyed, whatever, they love to tout it. They love to talk about it, but they don't want to talk about this aspect. And, you know, I don't think it's particularly important, broadly speaking, as much as they make it out to be with every one of their appointees, the first Indian who was born on top of this mountain in this state. But but it is important to show the shift in the Democratic and the Republican Party and the way that these voters are moving, the way that these voters are going. She's a wife of a Border Patrol agent. She pushed that pretty strongly. There's this idea in New York City and D.C. that the Border Patrol agents are like a bunch of Irish cops who just ride around mowing down Mexicans, when in reality, it's a bunch of Hispanic immigrants who make up our Border Patrol, patrolling people from all over the world who are trying to illegally break into our border. So she just busts through a lot of the cartoons and also busts through the wall that they've tried to create, the myth they've tried to create that there's no such thing as her, that's just white bigotry or Trump voters, etc. She breaks down all of the caricatures they have. And it obviously doesn't help that she's a young, beautiful woman running against a corrupt, fat slob.
Okay, so we weren't even planning on talking about this, but Chris, I just teed you off and you were like already wound up. Yeah, you were like already wound up, ready to go, apparently, which is great. But you just make a really good point. The first congresswoman to be born in Mexico, the first person elected to Congress to be born in Mexico is a Republican woman, which is, I think, a turn of events that warrants some consideration because Chris, it undermines their cartoons. It does. And I think what's important about that is it's actually undermining the premise of this entire worldview that they've been pushing on people for forever, which is that any ideas that disagree with theirs are racist and bigoted and uninclusive and hate diversity and hate everything. I know you hate diversity, Chris, but you have a different argument.
Diversity is just fine. It's just not a strength in and of itself. It's simply a feature. It's something that we've turned into an absolute cult. Now, the Democrats are funny. They released all these different books, and we talked about these in weeks past. All these different really intelligent and interesting books about how the future of the United States should be based on demographics. You've got Democrats cheering the decline of the white population in this country compared to other races because, according to them, because that would mean that there would be no more Republican victories. Then they have Democrats freaking out that Tucker Carlson just repeats their claims and Federalists and other places repeat those claims and say this is a objective of theirs. And then we have the best part of all is a total freak out when they realize that their strategy doesn't work, that demographics to a certain extent can show which way parties are going to go and which way politics are going to go. We've seen that throughout history of this republic, but they're subject to change. And a party that wants to represent the Hispanics of America, the voting Hispanics, needs to represent the voting Hispanics of America, not the voting Hispanics of Mexico or Honduras or Guatemala. They need to stand with American citizens. They need to have things that are on the list, the agenda list of that party. They can't just take them for granted. They can't just say, hey, we stand with Honduran citizens to fight against global warming and LGBTQ violence in Central America. What the hell does that do to help a Mexican-American citizen here who's worried about border control, prices, law and order, security? That doesn't help them at all. The Democrats took it for granted completely, ran a completely zany cartoon platform based on the wants of these people, which were completely informed by activists, and they're getting burnt by it. And it's, I was careful when I first saw this happening. You know, the Texas population of Hispanics has always leaned more conservative than the national population, but it's getting more so. And it's not just one off and two off and three off, because I've been careful watching it for a while now. It's been over and over and over again. And we're not seeing a lot of course correction from the Democratic Party. We obviously saw course correction from our opponent, Rice, but we saw a lot of course correction from our opponent, but not from the broader National Party. And they're kind of inseparable.
Yeah. So the broader context that I was going for when I sort of stumbled into this segment was we were going to talk about a couple of bills that are before Congress, and we'll get to that. But the reason that the segue made a lot of sense is because I was talking about it in the context of, like, Democrats are getting really desperate. And last night's results, Tuesday night's results, I think put that into, add some perspective to why. But it's not just that. It's Chesa Boudin. It's the recalls of school board members in San Francisco. I think three school board members in San Francisco. It's potentially a recall coming for what, the DA in Los Angeles. The last few years, I would say post 2020, have allowed full progressivism, untempered by any real opposition, to play out in lab conditions in many of our major cities, in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, I would argue in New York, in Philadelphia, where I think there's also a similar campaign going on. And Democrats are getting schlacked, but and not by just your crypto fascist, random Wall Street American psycho San Francisco residents. It's actually in San Francisco was coming from a huge push from Asian Americans. It's coming from minority voters. It's coming from people who've seen the results, the disenfranchised people, the people who were supposed to benefit from these progressive policies understand that the opposite has happened. And I think, Chris, this is sort of adding to Democrats' desperation in Congress, which we'll get to in a minute. But these results, as they keep coming in, you've been doing this for a while. I mean, it's always a fun media game to read into primary results and to read into early midterm results as sort of previews of what might happen in November. These races are being, some of these are recalls, and they're so decisive. Flores's victory was so decisive. I mean, this is really interesting stuff. Am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. A lot of primaries are local, and there, of course, there were local aspects that played into this one. But to the Democrats versus the Republican point nationally, when you've got a county here or a district that is on the U.S. border, that is the number one overriding issue. And when you've got Hispanics going with the Republican, his Mexican-born candidate to crack down on that kind of garbage and that kind of crime, the lawlessness, well, that has absolutely and mandatory national implications. It's kind of like when Scott Brown won the Massachusetts primary, the Massachusetts Senate race, special Senate race. I mean, all politics were local. People were certainly, he ran against a terrible candidate, but there was a national excitement to the race that had to do with Obamacare. This was even less so nationally driven because there wasn't a huge amount of focus on it. There wasn't the huge amount of money like you saw. It wasn't a national race that everyone was closely paying attention to. It was just the political watchers. But it still happened because that's where the mood of the electorate is. Now, I mean, again, the border Hispanic communities whose farms are being trampled, whose kids are being threatened, who have people who are finding bodies in their fields every month, they're going to be a different demographic than those in the center of the United States or northern United States. But it's just, it is, like you said, it's a trend that everyone ought to be paying attention to. And if I saw those results and I was a Democratic consultant with a bunch of pro-immigration or even hardliners in immigration candidates, well, I would still be very worried.
Yeah, I'm looking at the results right now. Mayra Flores won with 51% of the vote to her opponent's 43% of the vote. This is a district that I think Hillary Clinton won by like 30 points back in 2016. That's a pretty stunning flip. And I think one trend line that a lot of professional national pundits are trying to graft onto results is the Trump endorsement. You know, the Trump endorsement means nothing. The Trump endorsement means everything. And you've seen them struggle to make that narrative really work because the facts are way messier. But when you can really draw a clear line from Glenn Youngkin and Winsome Sears' big victories last fall through what we're seeing happen in these upsets, what we're seeing happen in these recalls, these actually do all fit the same narrative. And it's wild overreach by Democrats. They're being rebuked not merely by, I mean, Winsome Sears is a great example. You have a Black woman who can get into these issues of social justice and Mayra Flores and, you know, Boudin being recalled by Asian Americans. Glenn Youngkin, a huge part of his victory was Asian Americans who were upset about what was happening in schools in Northern Virginia. So this line that anybody who opposes us that really coalesced after 2020 into a motto of the left, any opposition to these very extreme policies, the mayor of Minneapolis being booed out of who was like so completely progressive and in line with all of the far left's ideas, except for, I believe, defunding the police or abolishing the Minneapolis Police Department, one of those two. He gets booed out of a rally for just saying that. 2020 was just the intensity of the fervor. It's hard to even remember exactly how strong it was. And now it's played out, and I think you can pretty clearly see it's Dem overreach, but it's also this very specific Dem overreach that cuts at the heart of this nonsense that they've been peddling for a really long time.
You're right, and the massive swing away from Clinton is really shows exactly where this is going, and how this overreach has been going on for years. But now it's becoming more national because you always had the regional parties. I mean, when I used to work for a company, Ballotpedia, it was an intern there, like a dozen years
when
ago.
When the heck did you work for Ballotpedia?
I was a fellow there in like 2010. just filling in data. I remember going to all the different Democratic politicians' websites, and the Democrats do okay in Texas broadly. You know, I mean, obviously not the majority, but they've got a number of seats. And going through, and all of them were to the right of Massachusetts Republicans who I'd grown up with. All of them had guns and border protection and life and things like that on their front page. Now, obviously, that started to change in the years after. We had Pink Sneaker Lady and the rest going there. We have Beto going out there, and we kind of become like the national face of the Austin, Texas hard lifestyle of politics. I don't think it's really been making a lot of inroads. But every single year, they keep on predicting that Texas is going to get more liberal. And I'm sure there are areas that are. They've got a lot of people coming from California and Colorado and other garbage states. But it's just the ability, all of these things, all of these trend lines, all these things that we watch and take care of like they're some kind of science when they're not, turn out to just be completely disastrous if you don't take into account shifting policies. And the policies of the Democratic Party are pretty quite divorced from the needs of those of that electorate, aside from, you know, white liberal white people, and they're paying a price for it.
Right. So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free pricing on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. John Daniel Davidson and I were actually in the Rio Grande Valley last week on a reporting trip. We spent a chunk of it in northern Mexico, a good chunk of it in northern Mexico. And John will be on the podcast soon to detail our experience and what we saw. But we'll have more specifically on the RGV. But this does really make what's happening not too far from us, Chris, on Capitol Hill especially relevant, I think, because the push from Amy Klobuchar and people who support this tech bill, I really think it's something that Democrats want to do for electoral purposes. I think the same is true of the gun bill. And we're going to take each of those one by one. We're going to start here with the tech bill because you've been following it really closely. In particular, Chris, we talked about it a week or so ago, but there have been developments since. Basically, this hinges on whether Chuck Schumer, who I believe his daughter works for Facebook, and I think one of his daughters works for another big company like that, whether he brings this bill to the floor. It came out of committee. It seems like it probably would pass. Senator Mike Lee was on this podcast last week and said he didn't think it was a good piece of legislation, and he was hopeful that Republicans wouldn't help it pass. But Chris, I think you have a different take on that.
Yeah, I think this is our chance to pass it. We talked about it a little over a week ago, where the reality that is that every single Republican voter knows this is a huge problem going on in Silicon Valley and with big tech. It's our number one concern. It comes up all the time. It's not our number one concern, but it comes up all the time in conversation, casual conversation, policy conversation in Capitol Hill. And when Republicans always like to say, well, this isn't the perfect bill, fine, but it is the bill to make a difference. And if Republicans gain control of the Senate and the House, they're not going to get Democratic support. So they need to try and bring on this coalition. Right now, they've got everyone from Ken Buck to Ted Cruz to Holly to the Democrats here on this. They've got Klobuchar is obviously leading it, but there was a poison pill that was kind of pushed out today by four Democratic senators, Brian Schatz, Ron Wyden, Ben Ray Lujan, and Tammy Baldwin. And they all said that they like the bill, and all of us doing the American Innovation and Choice Online Act. They like its aims. They think they're, quote, worthy, but they were concerned that it cracks down on the ability of companies to attack other companies that were more free than they were. So, for example, that Twitter couldn't or Google couldn't push down on search results that advertised for Bing or for Parler or for some other place that were truth, some place that was more free than what they offered. Basically, what these senators are asking for is that this have all of the Democrats' hopes for the, and some Republican populist hopes for, cracking down on the antitrust aspects, but does nothing to deal with the insane political censorship that we've seen from Silicon Valley. Now, this may be something that they want. Of course it is, because right now the censorship is going their way. The fact that Gmail appears to be a black box that decides that that Gmail is discriminating against Republican and conservative emails at a much higher level than they are against Democrats, marking them spam or simply stopping them from going through. These are things that Democrats don't really care about. These are things that change elections, though, and they should care about it. Now, the thing about this poison pill is they're saying they're not going to vote on it unless it gets rid of some of these things. And if they get rid of some of these things, then Democrats are going to, or Republicans are going to, pull out of supporting this bill, and this bill is not going to pass. And the theory here is that if they don't get rid of this stuff and they completely ignore Schatz and Wyden and Lujan and Baldwin, well, those senators will probably still vote for this bill because it's so unpopular right now to be pro-big tech. So it seems like it's just a trap that they have to be careful about. But like you said, it all does, at the end of the day, come down to Schumer, who's promised to vote this summer. They're thinking late June, early July, but promises in D.C. aren't worth that much.
So can you give us a little bit more information? And again, we have talked about this before. The bill basically, as you just explained, prevents these platforms from favoring their own businesses, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, in ways that people are really familiar with. If you think about Google Maps, or actually the CNBC article cites Amazon Basics. And we've all seen that in our search results. So Yelp and Spotify have come in and said that they support this. I think Sonos supports it. DuckDuckGo, of course, supports it. But Chris, in the nitty gritty of this bill, tell us what you think the real consequence of it would be, like the positive consequences from your perspective.
I think it would really have a strong impact against some of the biggest and most devastating monopolies we have in this country. Google over information and their inability to ferret information toward their own products and their own services in their own way and the things that they control. And another one, major one, would be Amazon and their ability to undercut the American small business and the American even medium-sized and large business with products that they use. They take all the information, as a good example of what this bill would do. They take information from customers who buy, say, a Sears ceiling fan from Amazon.com. They take all that information and they use it to undercut Sears by creating alternative products that are cheaper and are advertised higher. Those kind of things would be banned. It also hits down on their ability to suppress competitors on their own platforms. So that's what the Democrats are more concerned about, is like, well, there should be something to do with content moderation. They should be allowed to discriminate based on platforms' content moderation. And that's the poison pill that would be deadly.
Mm. Have you seen criticism? This is a good example of a bill that, again, Senator Lee was on this podcast just last week, I think, giving a pretty reasonable criticism of the bill. But Chris, have you seen any criticism of the bill from the right that's been persuasive to you?
I mean, I don't think that the bill is perfect. I don't think that all of the aspects of it would be something that I would want. I don't know. I think that there's some danger to some of the crackdowns on favoring your own platform, although the bill does everything it can to try and fix that. I'd like to see some language tightened up, but it's not the perfect bill because it is a Washington, D.C. bipartisan bill. What these four Democrats are trying to infuse into it would make it just disastrous. But it's not going to make every single person happy. What I'm satisfied with, what makes me happy, is it's going to make Google and Amazon extremely unhappy. And I think they are enemies of the American small business owner. They're at Google, at least, is messing with our electoral process consistently. It's messing with our free press and our First Amendment fairly consistently, or at least it's warping our speech in this country. So that's what I'm happy about. And I think Mike Lee has extremely intelligent criticisms of most things he's against. He thinks about things very deeply. But to look at this in the strictly political sense, this is the last chance we're going to have for years to try and really have an impact on this. Republicans aren't going to do it on their own, and Democrats aren't going to help a minority of Republicans do it on their own if Republicans are in charge. So I want to take that shot.
So that's where I wanted to go next, was the political incentives, because to our earlier point about election results over the course of the last 6 or so months, and now as we're actually in the midterm cycle, Democrats are... this bill's life cycle has been really interesting. I don't know if you share that perspective, but it sort of like heats up and then stalls and then heats up and stalls. It seems to be right now hotter, at least behind closed doors, because it just needs basically Senator Schumer to Majority Leader Schumer to bring it to the floor. And the political incentives for Democrats to go after these tech companies, and the bill is structured so that it targets a group of specific companies, Google, Amazon, Facebook. Am I missing anything in there? Apple, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly.
Yep. So it's structured in a way, but the political incentives for Democrats to get this done, they're having a battle, sort of like the one happening on the right that we cover a lot, over this bill on their own side. Are they not, Chris?
What was the question?
The left is having a battle just like the one that's happening on the right, basically in the tug of war between Klobuchar and Schumer. Do we bring this bill to the floor? As they're debating whether or not to do that right now, whether or not it's good or bad for their members to vote on this, I think Klobuchar would say it's important for their members to vote on this ahead of the midterm cycle so they can go back to their districts and to their states and say, look at what we did. We're taking on big tech. And Chuck Schumer may be persuaded by that argument. What do you think about that?
I think that Chuck Schumer is more worried about just the political wins. I don't sense a very principled Democratic opposition to this bill, like I sense with some of the Republicans who are just corporatists and protectors of any corporate want. Democrats, with a few exceptions, aren't necessarily for that. But I do think that they're worried about the pressure campaign that's been brought by big tech lobbyists, the tens and tens of millions of dollars that have been spent. I think it was a $23 million ad buy was announced just 2 weeks ago to try and sway senators and congressmen. The big tech is claiming that this is an existential threat, which makes me wonder if it actually might be, which makes me smile. Big tech is trying to feed the news that the bill is splintering, that there's no momentum behind it. But I think Schumer will go where he feels that the momentum is. So there are organizations and groups, outside groups, that are pushing for this. And if he feels like this vote is wanted by his caucus and Republicans, that he thinks that it will pass and it's ready, I think he'll bring it, because nobody wants to be seen as being pro big tech. But if he feels like if the big tech lobbyists are successful in scaring enough Democrats and Republicans into saying this will destroy American innovation, our security will be destroyed, China will win if you try to stop big tech, which is completely insane. If they're able to do that and make it seem like this actually is going to take political capital and could lose, then Schumer will run from it. I don't look at him as a very bold and principled leader.
No, nor do I. In the interest of bringing in the counter arguments here, I'm reading an AEI list of the counter arguments against this bill, and some of them are just sort of obvious. They say it gifts brand value, product placement, and software to companies that have never earned or built them. Well, if you cut through the spin in that language, like, that's the most charitable way you could describe what the bill does in terms of not favoring your own. Speaking of things that you haven't earned, if your product outside of the platform, because you're this huge company that does absolutely everything, and you're favoring a product that hasn't earned the market share other than the fact that another part of your business has, then you can sort of see through the spin on that.
Yeah, I mean, if you go on Amazon and you Google, I'm just looking at some shades I just put up. If you go on Amazon and you Google 3 foot wide, 58 inch long, or whatever, semi light blocking shades, I'm going to get 10 results or 15 results before I get to what I actually want that aren't what I want because that brand is favored.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
Right. And we know that they crib other people's.
And I don't mind the ones that are labeled ad. Get it. And sometimes I click on the ad and I'm like, that's actually what I want.
Well, yeah. And so they also do this. They continue to say the bill would weaken cybersecurity. And what's this other one? Turn viable.
I've heard that it will weaken cybersecurity multiple times. I've seen a lot of people, almost everyone outside of politics, outside of the actual Senate and House, who is saying that I haven't seen anyone actually who hasn't been paid by big tech, to the point that Politico's tech reporter said, are there any voices? This is like an open source question on Twitter. Are there any voices for this that aren't taking money from big tech? And the reason why that's interesting is because I still haven't seen any proof of that. I mean, these are companies like Apple that are giving their encryption keys to China, and they're saying that big tech security would be threatened by them having competition, because then they wouldn't have the resources to be secure while they give our encryption, their encryption codes to China. It's just, they haven't, the burden should be on them to produce the evidence. And so far they've been saying that for months, and I've yet to see any.
Yeah. The one that of this entire list, the one that really does strike me as interesting is that it would damage the seamless iPhone experience that many customers love. I could see the bill doing that, although I also am confident in Apple's ability to wriggle around that.
Yeah, so Apple's probably talking there about the little walled mind control gardens they have called the Apple Store. That'd be my guess what they're referring to in that, which is that only their approved apps that basically allow them to practice Prima Nocte on them are allowed into their store. And they claim that that's essential for every aspect of the user interface and the user experience and their security. And that if we don't let Apple pillage all of our private companies before they come to us, then we won't have a good experience on iPhones. I don't know. I mean, it's been a couple of years. I remember, what was it, 4 years ago when the first $1,000 iPhone came out, and people were aghast at the level of decadence that entailed. And now you can't get a regular iPhone for $1,400. I'm sure they could figure this out. And by the way, I have no problem with hurting Apple. That's one of the aspects of this. Companies like Apple and Amazon and Google have used their monopolies to create serious damage to American small business owners, to competition, to, in some ways, to free information and free speech, and some of these companies are electoral process. So, like, I don't really mind a little bit of tears from them.
I guess I think the valid counterpoint in that case would be it's hurting consumers. It's not just hurting Apple consumers who rely on the quote seamless system, which as a serial Apple user, I actually do think is pretty legitimate. That said, I do think what you also said is legitimate, that Apple has ways to get around it. Although where you prioritize that in the list of things that are addressed by this bill is another question. And we'll see, I think, how, if Schumer brings this bill to the floor, it'll be really, that's where you're going to see the battle lines be drawn in helpful ways. Although I suspect you're right, Chris, that because nobody in this midterm season, where Democrats are in a very precarious position, precarious actually is an understatement, are in they've dealt themselves a losing hand. They're not going to want to be on the side of big tech. There's a handful of Republican senators who will absolutely support this. So I would imagine that it would pass, but it would be.
People want to vote on the right side. Once it comes to the floor, people don't want to be seen as being pro big tech. And just one last thought on Apple, because I mean, the Apple experience can be nice for users for sure. That's what they're famous for, but they wouldn't be in this position if they hadn't used that power for evil. If they hadn't decided that companies like Parler would be kicked off of their platform for a couple of days during the biggest rise and surge in downloads they've ever had for completely spurious reasons. If they didn't feel like they owned a right to, what's it, 30% of the profits or something like that of every single application that uses their store, if they hadn't used their power to pillage and to make arbitrary decisions that favored one side of the political debate against the other, then they wouldn't be in the crosshairs of both Democrats and Republicans right now. Big tech used to be a place that was defended by cross-eyed Republicans who just didn't want anyone to say anything mean about big business for years while Democrats were concerned about the power. Then big tech turned around and used its power to wield it against Christians and conservatives and Republicans and the working poor and to help China undermine the United States. And it turns out now they've got no allies and they've got no one to blame but themselves. So their friendly user interface that I've enjoyed since the dumb iPod came out, which I still have.
The dumb iPod.
Actually, I like the iPod. I'm just kind of annoyed right
too.
Now.
Yeah.
Their easy to use user face is great, but if you're undermining my country, then you're going to get hurt.
I actually think we peaked with the combination of the iPod and the landline, or the iPod and the dumb phone. I really feel like that was a peak
Yeah, I agree.
Tech, and it should have been the peak, but instead we kept pushing forward in the name of progress.
And now your battery lasts for 5 hours.
Yeah, well, actually, no, my battery, I have like the best iPhone possible right now, and I'm very happy with it. The battery lasts a really long time. Same on those fancy iPads we have, Chris. The battery life on those is fantastic.
Well, I hope you're getting paid.
I wish I were. Instead, I just pay Apple. The one. Instead, I just pay Apple. But the political incentives to get this gun bill passed as well, we only have a framework of it, but I think, you know, there's an element of catharsis to this for both the public and lawmakers after these mass shootings, after Buffalo and Uvalde. There's an element of like legislative catharsis. It feels like they did something. There's also an element of, you know, that catharsis comes with political expediency. So you're also, in addition to feel personally like you took a step in the right direction. I think that's what Mitch McConnell said. He called the framework that he'd seen a step in the right direction. You're also able to say, you know, you did something to your constituents who, of course, want you to say that you did something. And with Democrats, again, in a very tough position, they feel like this is a good issue for them in most places. I actually think they're probably right about that. Not all places. I think this is an issue that's a winning one for them with like suburban moms. But the point is, the principle of this framework is, I would say, questionable at best. Red state laws, there would be block grants if this framework, we don't have the text of the bill yet.
Red just flag laws.
Red flag laws. What were you saying?
Yeah, you said red state laws.
Oh, sorry. Red flag laws. Definitely not red state laws. But because I was making the point that they differ between state to state. That's probably why I said red state. If you're in a state like California, whether that red flag law is constitutional or principled is a very different question than when you're in another state, say a red state, for instance. And whether the red flag law is effective is also a very different question, because look at what happened in New York with the Buffalo shooter, who had been institutionalized. He had been hospitalized a year before the shooting for threatening a school shooting, and was still able to buy a gun. They had a red flag law in that state. It did not work. So, Chris, Democrats really want this to pass. Republicans really want this to pass. That's why you have John Cornyn pushing so hard for it. That's why you have Mitch McConnell saying it represents a step in the right direction. Where do you see this shaking out?
I think I see it most likely shaking out in a betrayal of Republican voters, but they have because like you said, these are laws that have already been passed in a lot of these states where they've had them, then the federal level or once they get more broad, they start to get up against Second Amendment rights and First Amendment rights and become extremely unconstitutional and Fourth and Sixth Amendment rights. They start to get and run aground and run afoul. I think it's really incredibly shameful that Mitch McConnell put together a group of 10 Republican senators, a lot of whom are retiring, none of whom are facing re-election, all of whom think that they are safe. 10 Republican senators is enough with Democratic support to push this over the line for sure and to get it passed and see what the courts do after that. But I think some of the things that we should take from it are that John Cornyn can never be in Republican leadership. He doesn't think he's under electoral threat for this. He should be wrong. He should be held accountable for that. But he can never be in Republican leadership after he pulled this. And two, there may be an interesting savior that stops this garbage from going through, and that is the hard left. AOC has probably most succinctly voiced these concerns when she said that she was concerned that this would deny guns to people who failed different kinds of background checks and looks at different kinds of mental illness and previous crime, that it would disproportionately affect this or that group. And that it would dig into some of the more childhood records, et cetera. And she was concerned about the privacy aspects of that and how it impacted what she called her community. That kind of thing might start to make Democrats more suspicious of this bill and might cause the progressives to rebel against it. And then you're just going to end up with which often happens. I'm not sure about this time, but often happens with bipartisan gun legislation. It's just kind of Lucy in the football, where the Democrats hold out a bill and say, we're willing to work with you on this, we're willing to compromise, and Republicans run in for the kick and they pull the ball and everyone looks really stupid. Pat Toomey has been falling for this since he came into the Senate. And Republicans, it's kind of just a repeat comic at this point.
Right. A lot of good points. And I was talking to Inez Stepman on NatCon Squad, another podcast that we do just yesterday. So Tuesday, when we taped it, and she raised another really good point, which is that the problem with schools is not being underfunded. And that's that's a great and evergreen point about just about every legislative solution that Congress comes up with, which is more funding when the problem is structural. The problem is efficiency. This country is so, and I genuinely mean it when I use the word decadent, that we cannot perform basic functions no matter how much money we throw at them. And Uvalde is sadly a very good example of that. We still do not know why the door that was supposed to lock automatically did not lock. Automatic door locks, all of these things are reasonable. Like the federal government, if you want to make sure every single public school in the country has the money to make these reasonable changes, updates for safety, great, do it. But we don't even have any reason to believe that those are what's at the heart of this, because these schools are fairly well funded. Mental health programs are fairly well funded. And this catharsis, as satisfying as it might feel in Washington and as satisfying as it might feel to voters who hear about it, it's actually really sad that we can't be more innovative, that we can't be more creative, and that we can't agree on certain basics of all of these problems when they happen. Like, we can't say, what is a specific way to make sure what happened in Buffalo never happens again in any state that is constitutional, and what are some things that will approach solving that problem? What are some of the things that will approach solving the problem in Buffalo? What can news organizations do to cover these more responsibly? These questions are all legitimate, and they get flirted with every time we deal with one of these tragedies. Then they get thrown to the back burner as these huge pieces of legislative catharsis go through and throw money at problems that already had a lot of money thrown at them.
Yeah, it's just a conflict of visions that Thomas Sowell wrote about, where we come at it from completely different ideas of a human nature, the role of government, good and evil, right and wrong, prevention and response and punishment. And when you have those kind of different ideas, it's really hard to agree on anything. Except right. For raising money in politics, getting more votes, making more promises, cutting campaign ads and starting over again.
Right. No, I think that's correct. So what's happening on Capitol Hill is a direct response to the serious electoral problems Democrats are facing that seem to heighten with every Tuesday election. I don't want to say cycle, but every Tuesday election spree that we go through. It's only June, and they don't seem to have any end in sight. They're not going to have to, I think, there will be no reckoning for them over all of these progressive experiments they pushed on the country, the people who died in the 2020 riots, the people who have been targeted by criminals who were treated with leniency by prosecutors. These folks who talk in abstracts about social justice and have spoken in non-abstracts by casting everybody else as a bigot, these very serious charges over the years, they will never have to reckon with it. Although Democrats are at least trying to stanch the bleeding as they reckon with it politically for now. Anything else on we're seeing go through Congress, Chris?
I think you're right. I think it would take 1984 level beating for Democrats to say, wait a second, maybe we are on the completely wrong foot. I don't think a midterm is going to do it. I think it's going to take Joe Biden getting absolutely destroyed after a destructive midterm to possibly make it seem to the Democrats that maybe there's something to this beyond just our entire nation being made up of bigots. Maybe we are wrong.
And even then, when you're sort of swimming in the sea of moral relativism, unless anything really shakes that to its core, shakes that sort of foundation, new foundation, the anti-foundation of the education and the cultural conditioning that we all live in this country, it's just it's hard to see. My prediction is that we just keep seeing this in 5-year cycles, and it's a perpetual tug of war between sanity and insanity, but we'll see.
You don't try to be too optimistic for me now.
Yeah, usually you're the sunny, optimistic one. Well, Christopher Bedford, co-founder over at RightForge, which I'm sure has plenty of clients that would benefit from the American Choice and Innovation
Act. Yeah, actually, I'm sure a lot of them would. I mean, anyone who's trying to compete with big tech would. So full disclosure, I, as well as the rest of the country, would benefit from the destruction of big tech.
Chris, along with American culture at large. So Christopher Bedford, we always appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jasinski, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason, and then it faded away.